As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the ways that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19, from interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how this crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep Food Radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/yfood.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers who make up the food and beverage industry. My name is Ethan Frisch. I'm your co-host calling in from New York.
Hi, I'm Valerie Lomas. I'm your co-host calling in as well.
Where are you calling from, Valerie?
I'm in Baton Rouge.
That's exciting. And we're super excited to introduce our guest this week, who is a personal hero of mine and someone I've wanted to get on the podcast for a long time. And one of the, I guess, little features of coronavirus is that we are now recording remotely, and so we can bring people in from all over the country. And I'm really excited to introduce you to Steve Sando, founder of the cult bean company Rancho Gordo.
Nice to be here.
Steve, thanks for joining us. And I'm also just going to drop a quick plug right at the top for Steve's brand new book. Steve, you want to tell us what it's called?
Well, the Rancho Gordo Heirloom Bean Guide. And it's 30 of our favorite heirloom beans, a little history and a recipe for each one. But we also go into how to grow them and a little bit about profiles of the different farmers. It's something I've wanted to do for years. And it is a repurposed book that I had done previously with a traditional publisher that I wasn't happy with. So we've redone it completely and it's out. But we're only selling it through our website and independent bookstores, actually. We're not, people immediately go to Amazon, but we're not using them as a distributor.
Not on Amazon.
Oh, that's
actually
awesome.
I want to come back around and talk about that and some of the business decisions you've made related to that and Amazon and your own site. But let's step back and start at the beginning. How did you get into beans?
Well, I have no ag background and I actually have no cooking background. I think I was a frustrated home cook and I was really curious about why certain ingredients weren't available. I was shopping. I live in Napa and I went to the grocery store and there were hard pink tomatoes from Holland in August. And I really enjoyed cooking my whole life, but I really wasn't food aware in the sense that a normal person would be now. And I decided it didn't make any sense. And I tend not to have casual interests in things. So I immediately learned how to garden and then using heirlooms, why they were so much more interesting. And I erroneously felt I was really good at farming. So that's how I got started. It turns out anybody can grow anything in Napa. We've got incredible soil and weather. And if you have irrigation, you're good to go. But I felt it was me. But it's fine. I learned quickly.
And
I
think one of the things that really struck me about your product and what I hear from other people who love your beans also is how different they taste from any other beans that we have encountered before. Definitely supermarket stuff, definitely anything canned. What's going on?
Well, part of it is the heirloom aspect of it. And heirloom beans are open pollinated. If you take the seed, you're going to get the exact same plant. And it's the same thing with Brandywine or Cherokee Purple tomatoes. If you save the seeds, you're going to get the same plant. something like an early girl is a delicious tomato, but it's a hybrid. So you won't, it's not a GMO. That's something different altogether. And I think there's a place for all this, but there's mostly a place for heirlooms because they tend to taste better and they're bred for flavor. And usually they're bred by home gardeners. And I didn't, this is why it's good. I didn't have an ag background. I didn't really understand that commercial growers weren't growing heirloom beans. Commercial growers tend to, there are always exceptions, but they want to grow for ease of harvesting, consistency, the same color, and flavor really isn't something that comes in too often for what someone would want to do. So not knowing what I was up against was really a help. And also our beans tend to be, well, our goal was to have everything fresh, new crop, under 2 years, but we've actually been very successful and haven't had anything go over a year at this point. Whereas if you were to buy commodity beans in the grocery store and say it's somewhere in the middle of Ohio that doesn't eat a lot of beans, I don't know how old those beans would be, but it's many, many years. So oh, that's wow. Those are the differences. Yeah.
I never thought about the age of beans. I know that a little bit crosses with Ethan's spice company, Burlap and Barrel, which is another thing I think a lot of us might not even realize when we are buying these, you know, super shelf-stable products, that we are buying them from companies who may or may not have a priority in getting us fresh products.
Right, right.
Beans are having a moment right now. Can we talk about the moment that beans are having? Because I don't think I've ever seen so many people so excited to make beans. And I think this even happened before the quarantine, with people kind of where we are now all kind of leaning into those more shelf stable products.
Oh, for sure. Now, I think, you know, people like me have been screaming for 20 years, like, no, you can do this. Everybody seemed to get an Instant Pot for Christmas this year. Like, many people already had them, but everybody got them. Joe Yonan of the Washington Post came out with a book called Cool Beans. People are trying to eat less meat. All these things put together just really created a perfect storm right before this happened. And normally we have a very busy holiday season. And then in January, we get to relax a tiny bit, and it never happened this year. It just kept going and going and even getting more insane. And then the coronavirus hit. So it's been wild. I'm not taking a ton of joy in this because people are freaked out. So I would rather have it where they buy the beans because they love them and not because they're worried. But at the same time, I look at people's Instagram feeds, and it's just so impressive, the beans and sourdough that they're making. And people make fun and they roll their eyes about sourdough, and now beans too. I've actually seen people making fun of people cooking like the pots of the Le Creuset on their stove. We've seen it a million times. But there's a slight miracle that happens when you take this hard rock and turn it into something creamy. And you had a part of that. And I just think you're so proud, because otherwise you're calling to have your food delivered. And this is the one good thing about this virus and quarantine situation, is that people are learning how to cook. Well, some people.
How did you learn how to cook? Or what was the first time that you sort of experienced beans in the way that you described that transformation?
Well, I grew up in the Bay Area, and Mexican food was always part of it. So it was really exclusively pintos, although I do remember when black beans seemed to be all the rage all of a sudden, and I just thought worlds opened up to me. It just was always a part of our cooking, I think. I can't remember an aha moment, but I do remember growing heirlooms after thinking I knew everything there was to know about beans, and then it was a real Zape bean, and I grew it because it was pretty, not because I thought I needed more beans. And then to taste them, it was like, oh, there's just this hint of chocolate. There's a hint of coffee. It's just, and to me, it was just very frustrating. How is this an indigenous food of the Americas and we don't know anything about it? And then here in Napa, you have people making balsamic vinegars and other traditions from Europe that are totally secure, which you should do if you like it. But my goal was always that an average home cook would now say, oh, I'll do real Zape for that, because it's our own food.
Right. I love the point that you made about us leaning into the foods that are indigenous to North America, because that, I think, is also something that we don't really give a lot of consideration to. And last year, actually, I went to Santa Fe for the International Association of Culinary Professionals Conference. And they obviously have a very large community of Indigenous Americans. And when they were discussing like the crops that are actually native to our country, and the land that, you know, the North American continent, which was obviously like very connected and had trade routes within the continent, it was like so fascinating to think about how globalization, which in many ways is great that we are exposed to other people, but just learning about like what's indigenous to our land and what would naturally, obviously, best support our ecosystem, and what, you know, what's popular.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It just, there's sort of this old colonial, if it's Euro, it's good. And if it's indigenous, it's not really worth bothering about. It's not necessarily, not necessarily bad. I mean, I think Southerners have been fighting this for decades, and it's nice that there's new awareness. I get obsessed about things, like I'm not Mexican, but I love Mexican culture. So I do get wanting to do Italian balsamic vinegars, things like that. But it just, I just would really love if our indigenous foods were part of the conversation as well. Like, I don't want to go too nuts, but to me, it's fascinating. Yeah.
And I mean, you've taken the humble bean, right? Which already has like so much competition as a protein with like, with meat, right? And then people being low carb. I think you also touched on something about you started breeding some varieties because they have this aesthetic quality to them that's really enticing before they're cooked.
Yeah, but we just grow them. We don't breed anything. And there's a place for breeding. I think it's totally great. But my whole point is saving heirloom varieties. So there's a difference. Yeah.
Well, go
the
ahead.
Flavors are—it's really based on flavor for me too. In the end, like that's real. Otherwise, this would be a fun little story. But they taste great, and I have friends that have been, you know, watching what I've been doing for years, and they've been very sweet and pat me on the head, and then they finally eat them. It's like, these really are different. It's like, yeah, sorry, you're slow to the party, but yeah.
How did the connection to Mexico come about? Because I know you've got relationships with bean farmers in Mexico. You've been working with for a long time. And obviously the name of your company and the New World Specialty Products tagline, where did that come from?
Just my little obsessions. You know, I think I started out loving Cuban music in the 80s. That led me to Cuban food, which led me to also Cuban boleros. And then there's Mexican boleros and Mexican food. And suddenly I went from Cuba to Mexico in my obsession. And Mexican food is a really funny thing. It's almost like an onion, and you can look at the outer skin and you think, oh, well, I've got this thing down. And then there's just layer after layer. And even though it's been many years that I've been interested in it, I feel like I know less than I've ever known. Like, I'm pretty aware now what I don't know. And when you come in, people, you know, talking about their love of, well, I don't know. I don't want to be mean, but yeah, I know everybody thinks they've just discovered a secret that's been right under our nose. So you have to like, it's very cute. So it's nice, the enthusiasm. But for fun on my vacations, I would love to go to Mexico, and I always look for heirloom beans, and I would go to mostly indigenous women who would be selling them in the markets and think, I would love these I'd love to be able to sell these and grow these. And because it's a seed, you can plant them and you'll get the same thing. Like I said, if it's an heirloom. So I was doing that. I stupidly went down and offered some of these people if I could buy their beans for seed, which here sounds, sure, why not? If you're paying me, I don't care. But there, it's like they understand that the seed is the value, and seed's everything. And without the seeds, they're nothing. So it was really offensive, it turns out, that I was doing that. And they look at me and they're like, oh yeah, fat gringo, and I'm going to come out ahead. No, this is not going to work out. So they really shut down a lot. But I have two friends who live in Hidalgo, a state just north of Mexico state. And they, the three of us go on these trips, and I kind of hang back, and they first talk to the women and see how things are going and see if it's possible that maybe they can grow for us. So instead of buying seed, we're actually buying crops from really small independent farms. And it's been 12 years, I think, now that we've been doing it. And again, I know nothing about importing food. And if I did, there's no way I would have been doing this. But luckily, I just blindly went in like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That'll be fun. And it's been a huge success. So I'm very happy. And it's the same farmers mostly in the same villages. And it's not for everybody because we have gotten some bad deals where they just gave us their old crops thinking we wouldn't know the difference. And we dropped those farmers, but other farms we've gone. I mean, I don't want to sound too kumbaya about it, but you're seeing paved roads now on places that there weren't. And it's very exciting. And seeing the kids growing up and just them approaching me just completely like, what planet are you from? This is not going to work, to being totally excited. And it's really cute. It's really one of the most fun things I do.
That was really one of the first things that when I was starting Burlap and Barrel a few years ago that drew me to your company as a model, where there really were not a lot of other models of working with smallholder farmers, wanting to contribute and be a part of the community in a certain way. And then also being able to present a product to people in the U.S. that was different, that really stood out and was a great product on its own and had this really beautiful story behind it. So, I mean, to me, that's like, I just, that's why I cold called you 3 years ago.
People think that our beans are all from Mexico, but I need to be clear. We mostly grow in California and on the West Coast. The beans that are from Mexico are clearly labeled the Rancho Gordo Xaxac Project. And the Xaxac is a company that my friends own. And I really wanted to make sure they get credit for what they're doing because they're the ones doing the real nitty gritty. I just get to go on these great trips. So I wanted to acknowledge it was them. And it's probably 15% of our overall volume comes from Mexico. So it's really mostly a U.S. grown product.
Right. Can I ask about the beans? Because I am fairly new to the Rancho Gordo bean movement. But ever since I first got hip, I see the beans and I see people talking about Rancho Gordo like everywhere. And I'm not just talking about my foodie friends. I'm talking about like my friends that don't work in food. Like I saw someone yesterday, they made these gorgeous giant white beans that reminded me of some beans I had on a trip. And I asked them, I was like, what kind of beans are those? And they were like, oh, they're the Royal Corona Rancho Gordo beans. And I was like, wow. What are the most popular varieties? Is there a particular bean that like maybe represents the brand or represents what your customers are looking for? Or do you think your customers are just really open to like exploring just this, like, well, I guess for someone like me who's not so hip just yet, it just seems like a whole new world to explore.
Yeah, so, well, you're hip in my book. The funny thing is, I have had a long career doing different things. And it was when I started doing this garden, as I turned 40, and I thought, screw it, I'm doing this for me, because everything almost worked. And I just thought, I want to see the label I'd like to see in my pantry. I want the varieties I want. And so I don't really know, to tell you the truth. And throughout my life, mainstream society hasn't really been kind, you know, as this fat gay kid, that was really rough going. And I just thought, you know what, you have to make your own happiness since they're not going to do it. And then you find like-minded people. And I think that's what I've done with beans, especially 20 years ago. They're pretty hardcore people that were cooking beans at that point. They wasn't really so mainstream. And as we've gotten bigger, I mean, it seems like such a cliche, but the whole tribal marketing, and I can't take credit for being so brilliant about it. It sort of happened. People tell their friends, we start different things like the Bean Club. And before you know it, we're really able to support ourselves and in a really great way, and even start our own publishing company to do books and not use Amazon. And it's so, I don't know that they're so homogenous who our customers are, because I think some really like Eurocentric beans, like the Royal Coronas, which it's funny because they're a Oaxacan bean bred by the Italians, grown by the Polish. So it's true globalization, but in the best sense.
With the name Corona, which is, I mean, I know there's a Corona, California. I imagine it's like a...
Well, you know, Corona means crown. And I guess the virus looks like a crown. And the Italians have a Corona bean. And this is a different variety of that. And it's a happy coincidence that we're enjoying this quarantine with these beans. And I will tell you right now, that's our number one bean. So people, it's not like beer drinkers who stopped drinking Corona beer. I think bean cookers are a little smarter. So
I want that bean. It says it's coming back in stock May 21st, I think. I'm on the list to get an email.
So I probably should be smarter and look at web stats and trends, but I just kind of don't care at this point. We're really successful and I know how I like to cook, and hopefully you can come along and enjoy it. And we have, Ethan called it a cult, but we have a lot of enthusiastic members of our bean club and on our different pages. So I love pushing my taste on other people, but I also love finding out what they've done. And it's sometimes it's just shocking. It's like, I would never have done that. And that is such a great idea. So it goes both ways, but I'm not a marketing genius. I'm just reacting is what I would say.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or a small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its order hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/yfood.
And we're back. We're joined this week by Steve Sando, founder of Rancho Gordo, king of beans. I don't know what other funny titles can we give you.
So I like Bean King. That
Bean King.
I like hashtag Bean King. I want to
bean
be your buddy,
Bean Buddy.
You said?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes. That's Bean Buddy. That's king that's is a really little the, more friendly.
King's Fall.
So Steve, one of the things that I have always admired about your business is the value system associated with it, and your ability to turn down prestigious customers or certain sales channels if you felt like they didn't align. And I know there's a particular example around Whole Foods, but could you talk a little bit more about that decision, how you navigate saying no?
Well, I think it's knowing your worth and knowing that. And I actually, in the farmer's market, when I was doing that in the early days, a lot of people were so excited because they were going into Whole Foods. And then they'd say, but I need you to get on Facebook and vote for us as your favorite. And it's like, oh, I'm not doing that. It's just like, I want to be a grown up. This is the item. This is the cost. And it has value or it doesn't. And I'm not a particularly moral person, but I also just like, I don't know. And I hate to have moral food because I think people don't buy it. I mean, they might be attracted at the beginning, but if it doesn't taste good, it's not great. I don't know. I mean, Whole Foods is welcome to call and place an order. And if they pay for it, we'll ship it. But what you have to do, the hoops you have to go through to be in Whole Foods are ridiculous. So I'm not doing it. We've got other channels. And it turns out that independent grocery stores often are thrilled that you're not at Whole Foods, so they don't. They buy more and they're more supportive. And it's a little more work. We carry all our own accounts. We don't have any. We have one distributor who is a wonderful distributor in the Pacific Northwest, and that's just because they just place an order and we ship it. It's really simple. I think food distribution is really complicated, and when we were first doing it, nobody was really doing much direct to consumer, and especially in New York, we got total feedback. There's no way I'm living in New York or Manhattan and I'm going to buy my food on mail order. And it's like, well, then you don't get the beans. So we eventually we have a lot of independent stores, like in Brooklyn in particular, like Marlowe and Daughters. Is that, sorry, I'm Kind of.
Yeah.
They were really early, like, and everyone's like, do you realize how small and great that store is? It's like, no, I don't, because I don't. It's culturally, it's different. But I would rather be there because I think the right people see it. And it's almost like free advertising when you're in a great store like that. And I understand the inconvenience of not being able to buy it at a place like Whole Foods or Safeway or wherever. But I just, for us, the distribution game wasn't working and direct to consumer was. Because the other thing, I don't know if people are new to this, but if you work with a distributor, they'll say, oh, great, you're going to be in X store, and but they need a free fill. And I'm thinking, I don't know what a free fill is, but I'm pretty sure I'm the one who's going to get screwed. And it means that you pay for the delivery, and if it sells, they'll order again. It's like, no way I'm doing that. So we wouldn't do that. And they said, oh, we want to put you on sale. And you think, well, legally, I can't determine your price. There's a suggested price, but I can't. No, you're paying for the sale. So it's like, and I'm not General Mills. And it's like, no, I think we're good. I just love that with direct-to-consumer, for us through the mail order online, and also we have a small store, you control the story. So you can explain why your beans are twice as much and why they're 10 times better and how to cook them. Whereas if you're looking at a dusty bag of commodity beans, it's just a completely different game. So it just seemed much more interesting. I was really lucky that we had enough support, but you find other companies like Burlap and Barrel. What can we do together that would be fun? And everybody benefits. And there's a lot of ways other than mainstream or traditional distribution to get your product out there.
Do you have any particular pieces of advice or recommendations on how to do that for an early or fairly early stage entrepreneur in food who's struggling with all of those issues with Whole Foods and distribution?
Well, I'd say you need a better website, because you look at some of these, it's like, oh, it's bad. You know, and restaurants are known in particular for really bad websites that take up all your bandwidth, but you really don't know anything. I think a lot of specialty food stuff does as well. So that's, and photography, and I think you have to understand that most people really don't know how to cook. They're interested in it. They find it intriguing. So you have to really appeal to those brand new people, and also someone who's really upset that you don't grow cocoa beans from France because you want them in your tarbe instead of in your cassoulet instead of tarbe beans. So you have both extremes, but someone should go to your website and know, oh God, these guys get it. They love their product. And I think that to me is really one of the worst things. I guess that's my advice.
another thing that you, I don't know if you told us this outright or we just sort of learned it, but another thing that we learned from you pretty early on, which has been a game changer for Burlap and Barrel, has been to focus on an older audience, or at the very least appreciate an older audience. I see a lot of new food companies launching where people are essentially selling to themselves. So it's young people targeting young people. And I tell people this all the time, and I can't speak highly enough of having an older customer base, because the loyalty, the enthusiasm, the engagement, we have, hundreds, if not 1,000 reviews on our website, because people just like, they get into it. They like being a part of a community, and millennials are resistant to that, where people of earlier generations are not. And that's
how interesting.
We are definitely less loyal. It's like, if it's working right now, it's working, and otherwise, next.
Well, sure. There's even a major food publication that did a whole thing on heirloom beans. And you know, when you write a post, the title is what, sometimes the link is what the title was, and the title was Alternatives to Rancho Gordo. And then they went looking, couldn't really find any. So the article was basically how to cook our beans. But I thought that, I hate that. Like, when we say beans are having their moment, it's like, there's a level of, and I wouldn't say it's just millennials. There's just sort of a hipster, what's the next thing? And Rancho Gordo's hot. Well, great. What's after Rancho Gordo? It's like, oh, can't we just incorporate it into the way we eat? I'm currently obsessed with, cornbread, because it goes great with beans. I love chard and collard greens and kale and things like that, and they're perfect with cornbread. So I'm totally in love with Anson Mills and what they're doing. But there are a couple of other brands which are also great, but people are like, oh, this one's way better than Anson Mills. And I just want to say, if it wasn't for Anson Mills, you wouldn't even know about heirloom corns or antebellum coarse grinds. And it's like, there's room for everybody, but that hipster part of it to me is really off-putting. But I can't take claim for marketing to older folks, because we just don't, I think they found us. And you're right, they're much more faithful. And the other secret is, especially in food, no one's marketing to them. It really is for hipsters, and it is about deliveries. And so when our store was open, which sadly is closed for the moment, these mostly older women would come in, and you could just see, it's like, finally, something for me. And you know, they don't want to go to Chico's for their clothes. Like, there's just, I mean, there's a certain people that do, and I'm sure that's a lovely look. But in general, everything's marketed to younger people. But it's like, these women control the home. They have the money. And they come in, it's like, yes, you get what I want to do. And maybe I'm not completely vegetarian, but I'm trying to cut back. Or I am vegetarian, and you've got enough. Everything you do, or we're doing, is fitting with that demographic. But that's luck. That's not me. But I respect them, and I think maybe they know that. And I also think it's such a mistake talking about how do you appeal to millennials. It's like, oh, they're just gonna have to find me, because I can't figure that one out. And I have no interest either in trying to appeal to a particular group.
But we have found you.
Yes. No. And I think it's because you're food oriented, you know, or foodies. It's not because I tried to figure out what music you like or talking slang.
I think what you're saying is also really important. Like, first of all, the product, because you have a great product, that speaks for itself. And then because you have people who really love your product and are very enthusiastic about your product, you're getting a very natural, organic form of marketing, which is word of mouth, which is people just sharing the beans, or sharing pictures or posts of the beans with other people, or these women who you speak of, maybe they're cooking them for their families or their grandchildren when they come to visit. And I think that's just like a really like beautiful organic way that that the product is being marketed, and so that we can all we can all experience the reality of a good bean, because like you know, I grew up in Louisiana. We ate red beans on Mondays with cornbread, and it was always the exact, I mean, I can just see the little bag of red beans and the brand, and you know.
Oh, and I buy Camellia beans, just, you know, too. I think I buy other people's beans. I really love beans. So yeah, I think it's smart you did that.
I'm curious, like, other than red beans, like, I was actually gifted some Christmas lima beans with Joe Yonan's new book. Where can those of us who only have very limited experience with cooking beans, like if we do get some Christmas limas, where can we get some like inspiration for recipes with these heirloom varietals?
Well, our website's chock full, plus the blog, plus the Instagram. I mean, it's really out there, but this is going to be the hardest part, especially with someone new to this. The word recipe just bores me so much. And everybody, like, I need just cook them with onion and garlic and a tiny bit of olive oil. And I promise you, you're going to figure out what to do. And frankly, there's just really almost nothing better than a bowl of heirloom beans. And you can tart it up, you can do exotic things, but you can't really better nature in that sense. So I totally get, especially when you're first coming into it, you want ideas and recipes, but the bean itself is incredible. Like, one of the reasons you cook beans is because you have that fabulous bean broth or pot liquor. And that's when you buy canned beans, you're supposed to rinse it off because it's so mucky and nasty. But I use it to make rice. It's a base for soup. So I always make sure my beans are very wet so they have extra bean broth. And if I have chicken stock, I mix the two in a jar in my refrigerator. So I just always have something stock related to put into the rest of the food. But it's very hard, especially with like what's new and what's next and what now can I be exciting. Just like, no, just eat this thing. And maybe if you're in Mexico, you'd chop some white onion and add that to the top and a squeeze of lime. In Italy, you might put just a tad bit of lemon and some Parmesan cheese. But to me, it's like, let's go simpler. But if you like recipes and you want them, there are a ton on the website. And now there are a lot of great books. I also have to talk about Crescent Dragon Wagon's book, Bean by Bean, which came out about 4 years ago. And it's a really kind of, I don't want to say old school, but it's a real comfort food vegetarian book as well, which is a good one. And plus, I've written books. You can think of those.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, while we're on the subject, let's talk about book publishing and how your approach has been different from from the mainstream, similar to your approach to Whole Foods versus specialty grocery stores. Tell us about your publishing operation.
Well, I wrote a book called Heirloom Beans with Vanessa Barrington, and that was our first book, and that was 15 years ago, and it's been in 7 printings. We got a really, I'll be honest with you, not a great advance, but you know, you're a young first time author, you're just so thrilled you're going to see yourself in a book, and it has sold like crazy over the years. Then the publisher had first right of refusal for the next book, and it was the same crummy deal, and I'm not doing that at all. So this was luck. Julia Newberry, who's our general manager, comes from book publishing. So she had connections with printers. And we thought, you know, let's just see if we can publish our own book. And we're lucky because we had a store at that point. We had a store in the Ferry Building in San Francisco, plus our Napa store, plus online. And the minimums are shockingly low to get a book published. And if you have the moxie, you can do it yourself. So the first book we did was Supper at Rancho Gordo, and it was fine. I mean, it wasn't very ambitious, and it was okay. But starting with the vegetarian we also did a Cassoulet book. I was doing other people's books too that interested in me. So we have a Cassoulet book. George Ann Brennan did French beans. I've done vegetarian cooking, and I'm now working on a big tome about Mexican food. I'm so tired of explaining how to cook beans. I really just want to write a book for me. So that's what the next book is. But what's funny with one of them, I did the photography is the other thing. And I love it. It's very fun. I had a book coach say, oh, I wanted to get a copy because you did self-publishing. So I sent it to her and she wrote back and said the photography was so bad and that you're competing with other James Beard Award winners and you've got to really be smart and pay money for photography. And the photography wasn't bad. Maybe it wasn't what she liked, but I thought it devastated me in a way that if she said the writing wasn't bad, but photography was very personal for me. And it took me a year to get over it. But I also realized she was wrong. I'm not competing with other James Beard Award winners. I'm trying to please Rancho Gordo people. And that's really a completely different mindset. Like, I don't care about the IACP Award or the James Beard Award as far as the book goes. I am thinking of the people in my bean club and what's going to make them happy that also makes me happy. So it was kind of an interesting thing. And that's really been our idea. So we have print them ourselves. We have tried selling them on Amazon, but when you do all the math and by the time you ship it to them and all the problems, we thought we're hardly making any money. So we just stopped doing it. And so now we just do it through the website and independent bookstores that call us. But unfortunately it's hard for the bookstores because we don't have a distributor. And I think for small stores, sometimes you really need them, but we're happy to carry the account. So most of the major food oriented bookstores in particular do carry them. Is that funny?
that's great. I think your next book should be a one-page book where all it says is, I don't care about soaking.
Yeah, I can't wait. Oh, please.
Don't ask me about soaking.
Yeah.
That's funny. I don't know. Any pieces of advice for somebody who's thinking about a book but may not want to go through traditional publishing, or that may not be an avenue that's available to them?
Well, I think you just have to make sure you have an outlet to sell them. So if you have a really nice blog and you have a couple hundred regular posters, it probably isn't going to do it. But as low as 2,000 copies can be printed. And my thinking is going forward, you could do really high quality, low quantity, and you're really only selling it to your specialty people. You don't have to worry about it. Like, for example, in the next book, I want to talk about when you cook something on a comal, and it's like, I don't want to have to explain what a comal is because someone who loves Mexican food already knows, and I don't want to help stupid people feel good about themselves. Like, I'm going to put a glossary in the back, but it's like, no, this book is for total Mexican people who love Mexican cooking, and I'm not going to explain everything that really should be obvious by now. So you can tell I'm a people person, and there'll be a glossary so they can look it up. But that's the kind of book I want to do, is a specialty book. And I think it's a better way to go. Alinea in Chicago, when they published their book, they self-published, and there's a great post somewhere, if you Google it, it's all about the breakdown of where the money goes in the book industry. And it's like, wow, there's just no risk for traditional publishers. And, you know, they have their role for sure. But I think unless you're doing a microwave, low-fat celebrity cookbook, you're going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that I have an opinion about things, but making enemies everywhere I go.
Can I,
Valerie?
I guess I just have like one final question that isn't even about business, but it is about beans, because I cooked some black lentils for my family, and I love lentils, and you know, my sister was like, ew, I don't like beans because they're mushy. So can we just, I just want to get your take on bean texture, because I have had people cook beans where they are, you know, a variety of textures. And I tried to tell my sister, just because I cooked them on the mushier side, like, you can maybe cook your own beans on the side of a little more al dente. I'm just curious, like, from the bean buddy, what do you have, like, what can you tell us about cooking and the texture of beans? And maybe this is like way too elementary for the one page book you're writing on soak your beans, but
you want them fully cooked though. I sometimes, you know, we have these farm dinners and the chef will cook, and I went to one and they'd made a bean salad, and it's like, these aren't cooked. I'm so embarrassed that my name is on them. So al dente is a tough one. Something like a kidney bean is firmer and has a thicker skin. And then something, we have this Marcella bean that almost has no skin, and it's almost gelatinous. It's so lovely. It might be your sister doesn't like beans. I mean, that just might be the other problem too. And like the ayacote or runner beans, like scarlet runners, you cook them and they're done and they're slightly potatoey, I would say. And then you keep pushing and they're almost like creamy and dairy. And so that's one bean that has two or three different stages, I think. Now, I don't know if she doesn't like mushy beans. I mean, no one likes mushy beans, and lentils are easy to overcook, especially, were they ours?
No, they weren't yours. Yeah. And I did overcook them because I was doing other things and I was
it's
not
super
paying
easy
attention.
Yeah, no, ours without soaking are 20 minutes, and people really don't believe that. And then at that point, you might want to puree them and make a soup. But no, it's a tough one. I'm not really sure what to say.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
No, but
maybe
that,
she wants one with
answer.
A thicker skin. But what you should do is do scarlet runners or the ayacote. Like a kidney bean type, like Camellia's red beans or our Domingo Rojo, and then do Marcella. So those are completely three different textures, and see if she responds to any of those.
That is a great idea. We can just have, it's like, oh, you think you don't like beans? We're having bean night. We're going to have a bean flight. Yeah. Three different varieties, and let's get
You're
to the bottom of this.
Make her eat three different beans just to make sure she doesn't like them.
Well, you know, it's so funny. This is what I don't miss our store a whole lot, except for the staff cooks beans every day and gives them a samples. And it's just, that is my favorite thing. It's like in the middle of the afternoon, I would just go get a shot of hot bean broth sometimes just as an energy drink. But just also being able to, I always, people say, what's your favorite bean? And I always have some stupid joke, what's your favorite child? And it's like, well, huh. But I go there and I eat these and I think, no, you know what my favorite bean is the last one I ate. I totally forgot that this bean, like the Mayacobas, are so good. And because we have 25 or so varieties. So I always say that my favorite bean is the last one I ate, because this one's good. So it's very fun having a product like that, I have to say.
Should we do a couple of rapid fire questions and then wrap it up?
Sure. I mean, I was going to ask what his favorite bean is, but we got a check mark on that. Your turn,
Ethan.
That
was salty and soaking.
Steve, how about one of the best meals you've ever had that cost under $5 or $10?
Okay. I'm sure it was tacos on the street in Mexico. And there's that moment where the fat from the meat mixes with the tortilla and it runs down your skin. And then you get the crunch of the onion and then the sour of the lemon. I just think a taco stand in Mexico is really one of the happiest places to eat. And it's well under $5.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to go with, what is your favorite spice?
Well, burlap and barrel, wild African cumin, actually, now that you mention it. Well, you know,
I love it. You know,
as a modern consumer, there's so many choices in spices. And I think for my family, no, I have talked about this all the time, that thing is like, okay, that changed everything. And you go on different jags. Like, I love thyme, and sometimes I think thyme is the greatest thing. I love our Mexican oregano. But right now, I'm sure this is offensive to someone Spanish, but I'm doing pimentón and cumin together, and just minute amounts of both. And if you can tell that it's what it is, you probably use too much. But it's a great combination. Ethan, is that a valid culinary thing?
No, completely. I put them together all the time. I love the combination.
Oh, good. Okay. And not a lot. I mean, just this little hint of, like, I did it in hummus the other day, and it's like, okay, that is really special. So I would say, and not just any cumin, I have to say, this Ethan.
Our wild mountain
cumin. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I did want to tell you, don't tell anybody. We haven't launched it yet, but we're about to launch a bean spice, not a spice for beans, but a spice made from beans. It's a Nigerian fermented locust bean that we're doing with a Nigerian chef friend of mine named Tunde Wei. And it looks like a bean. I'll have to send you a jar. We're just about to launch them, hopefully in the next week or two.
Did you say don't tell anyone,
but
Ethan?
The flavor, they're sort of flat. They look like a bean that's been cut in half.
Wow.
And the flavor is kind of halfway between chocolate and miso, if that makes any sense. There's this sort of fermented depth, but they're also really rich, and I'm really blown away.
But see, this is the difference between what we're doing and what someone else would be doing. Some people's like, oh, what's the next thing? Oh, no one's doing this, I'll do that. But I'm assuming you ate this, it blew you away. It's like, okay, how do we bring this to market? And that's kind of what I'm doing too. Like, these are the things that excite me. I'm not actually, it would be much more lucrative if we would just calm down and stop introducing new things, because we could really focus on the things we have, get our units
together.
But it would
be so boring.
Well, I'd love to be bored, really, at some level, but there's just too much stuff going on. So it's like, oh, and people need to know about this. So I think that's the difference. And hopefully, you know, we were talking about marketing and your website. The potential customer should smell that you love what you're doing. And if it looks like you're out to make money and make a sale, I think then go to the Whole Foods at that point. That's fine. But if it should be really a great, exciting thing, and they should feel that from you.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, let's wrap it up. Steve, where can people find you, find your products, find your books, follow you on social media?
Well, ranchogordo.com is the place to start, but I'm on Instagram. I don't even know what they are. So I think it's Rancho Gordo on Twitter, where I'm kind of nasty and have way too many opinions. I should really not be so political, but I can't help myself. And Instagram is mostly pretty pictures of beans. And you can always reach me at customer service at Rancho Gordo too. I get all my email. So all right. I'm around. Yeah.
Yeah.
And thanks to Jess, our amazing sound engineer. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind. As always, you can reach us at yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can find me on social at Foodie in New York.
And most of all, thanks to Steve Sando.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Fantastic podcast.
This felt like 5 minutes, so I really had a great time. Thank you.
And see you all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.